Take two. This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is August 10th, 1995. We're at the studio of Warrington Colescott in Iowa County. We include Art Hovey and myself. And Warrington is going to talk about his printmaking.
Okay. So I've got a great many prints scattered around the room here, and actually somewhat organized. From front to rear, from the early days of my work in prints up to the present. So it's a long period. I did my first formal print in 1948 in California. I had actually done some linoleum cuts as an undergraduate student at the university at Berkeley, doing political cartoons for the daily paper. My first prints that had, or that were attempting to have art quality, were done in Long Beach, California in 1948. A colleague at Long Beach Community College, where I was working, had studied at the Art Institute and had done silk screens. He was doing silk screens, Fred Heidel and his wife Florence. They showed me, I was interested, looking at their work. I had done no prints at all. I had not studied prints at Berkeley. And so it was really a new area for me. I was a painter. I was an exhibiting painter at that time. The silk screens were quite interesting, and I made my own equipment and began to experiment. This is probably my second or third attempt at a silk screen, and already I was aware of the field and that there were a lot of exhibitions, and I very quickly, as I completed these little prints, I did send some of them off to shows, and they were successful at getting in shows. One of the printmakers who was getting a lot of attention at this time was Leonard Baskin. This was after the war, of course, and Baskin was someone that had been in the war and became very active immediately thereafter with his woodcuts, grand relief prints, dwelling on the effect of the bombing in the late stages of the war. He had a famous print called Hydrogen Man, and showing a victim of the the hydrogen bomb, and this print was shown widely, and so in my print, which I called Atom Boy, it was a little very small satire takeoff on Baskin's Hydrogen Man. I approached silk screen entirely on my own. No instruction, not working with any group at all, but just in my own studio with my own equipment. And so I approached it very much in the way that I was doing paintings. Color was very important. It was a wonderful print medium for color. And in those days, too, the equipment was simple. You could make it in your basement. You could put it stretch silk, real silk, on wooden frames, and buy squeegees and the necessary equipment in commercial art stores. And so I built these small screens. And I did a number of things on this size, and then as I got more ambitious in it, my size began to go up, and I would try larger pieces. At the university, I was teaching, I came there in 1949. Okay, I had been doing silk screens, but I thought of myself primarily as a painter. The silk screens were very much a secondary thing, although I was exhibiting some of them. It was very interesting that there was so much going in prints at the university. The staff was very congenial, and I got along well. I enjoyed Dean Meeker, for example. He was a flamboyant character, as you know, and of a man of a great wit and humor, and good company. There were a number of us in the department felt that we had a lot in common. We came within 2 or 3 years of one another. We had come out of some kind of experience in the war. In other words, our lives had been interrupted by the war, and then we'd come back and we were kind of in a hurry-up mode to get on with it. And so we had had more life experiences, I think, than people similar in a similar situation today. I'd spent 4 years in the Army after undergraduate work and then gone back to school to graduate work. I felt my work was going well. The painting, I was a dedicated young artist. The first thing that I did when I got a place to live was to take over the main bedroom and make that into a painting studio or the garage or so forth. In other words, the life that I lived was around the place to make art. At the university, I taught design and drawing. Along with the rest of the younger staff, we felt that we were outrageously underpaid, and we were. So that we were, as a group, I think, under pressure to try to have some income from the artwork that we did. And again, that's a situation that I think has changed in the department today. To live in Madison, which is a pretty expensive town, with no financial resources and with this sort of miserly salary that starting staff had, you had to get out and hustle. You just to pay for the materials to make your art out of, you had to have some sales. I don't think selling ever influenced the quality of the work that I did or what I attempted to do, but I was out getting contacts in galleries. I was trying to arrange shows, and I would go to New York and to Chicago regularly, bringing my portfolio and my work, and to build up an apparatus where I would have some income from the work. And I was successful. I had quite a decent gallery in New York, the Serigraph Gallery. It was a gallery that was founded on the artists that were interested in this relatively new print material. And the woman that ran it, Doris Meltzer, was really a pioneer in putting together a gallery to show the work of artists that were working in serigraphy, as it was more formally called. I continued the work in painting and serigraphy. The serigraphy was secondary to the painting. the painting, I had quite a bit of success with the painting. I was in a Whitney annual and showed regularly at the competitive shows in Madison. I had galleries in Milwaukee and in Chicago. So the paintings were really the main thrust of my art. At the university, I was very interested not in teaching prints, but in teaching painting. And that took a little doing. The painting courses were pretty much dominated by people that had been there for a while, Robert Grilli and Sandro Zingali and others. So that painting was hard to wedge your way into, but eventually I had the chance to get a section. And so after a while I taught less design and the bulk of my teaching was in painting. I was particularly interested in working with graduate students, with the older, more experienced people that I could approach really on an adult to adult level. The undergraduate students were often difficult because they came to us with so little background, so little knowledge of the visual arts, that they would come with a very vacant idea of that they wanted to work in art, they wanted to make pictures, but they had seen only a handful of pictures in their lives, and they had seen Saturday Evening Post covers and Grandma Moses and so forth, so that they were really starting from zero. I could work with them, but it was hard work. It was really foot slogging work. Another more enjoyable level were the people of my age or older that were coming back, veterans, for example, GI students, and we had a lot of them. And they had a lot on their mind. Their lives had been interrupted. They had been doing something far from art, but they were full of things that they wanted to try, and that they had this hunger for art learning. And so they were wonderful to work with. I enjoyed it. And so my way of sort of working into the painting side was to take students as independents, grad students as independents, and to work with them, going to their studios. I didn't have a teaching studio in painting, but I could go to their studios and confer with them and work on a one-to-one basis. And that was marvelous teaching. And out of that, I worked with people like John Colt, for example, and Richard Kallner. I think Kallner was my first graduate student. He had been working with Bob Grilli, and Grilli had demanded that he leave the class because Kallner was, his work had a certain primitive fire to it that was far removed from Grilli's interests. And Kallner had seen my work, and he came and asked me to take him on as an independent. And that was the beginning of a friendship that has lasted until this very day. And actually, in the 60s, I worked for him when he was the chairman of the School of Art in Rome that the Tyler School of Art ran, a school, an art school in Rome that Dick was the chair of, and he invited me to come over and to teach printing in that school. And he ended up as the chair at SUNY Albany, the State University of New York at Albany, and has recently retired after a very distinguished career. So I think many of the people that from those early days went on to considerable careers of various kinds. Not all of them stayed in art. Some of them drifted into things that had an art relationship but were removed from actually the things that they studied. Don Kaufman, for example, is a very famous designer in New York. I think he just recently redesigned the Royalton Hotel. And there are many, many others that one could go into. We're looking now at an etching. It's probably my first etching. And this was a big shift for me. I had gotten more and more interested in prints through serigraphy. But at some point, I began to see the limitations of the medium. For me, you know, someone else might have gone on with serigraphy forever, you know, as Meeker did, for example. But there was a difficulty with drawing in line through the screens. The screens were just a little crude. I had been pushing and trying to achieve linear effects. I had been pushing to achieve more of a density, more of an openness in the screens. Instead of making very neat, tight screens, often I would do a screen and then I'd dunk it in water and have the glue melt and dissolve. You know, I tried to make my screens leak, for example, to get more textural, to get more open. We were not making screens photographically in those days, of course. It was handwork. You took a crayon and essentially you drew on the raw silk with a crayon, and then you covered the crayon with a resist of glue, and then you took out your crayon with mineral spirits, essentially. And so you started with a crayon-like drawing. The line essentially was a crayon, a litho-crayon type of line. Or you drew in brush with glue, or touche, with liquid touche, with brush. But I always like to draw in pen and ink. I like a point to draw with. And so that's the most difficult thing to do on a silk screen. The association with Sessler was influential. Sessler was a terrific workman, and we were all friends. We went to one another's openings, to the shows, and there were a lot of art shows in those days for the people in the region. It was a big show every year at the Wisconsin Union, big show at the Milwaukee Art Institute. There were shows at the Art Institute in Chicago. The museums loved to have big juried or invitational shows, something which is really a thing of the past, and it's unfortunate, so that communities don't know the artists who are working in their midst. But in the 40s and 50s, they did. The artists all knew one another. You knew the people who ran the museums and the curators. So there was a closeness to it. So I knew Al very well. And he's a very generous man, too, who was he was dedicated to his craft, and he loved to show, to bring people into it. And so he tried to get me hooked on etching, and I was interested. And I did a couple of little etchings under Al's tutelage. And I remember coming to the point that all people who approach etching come to, and you ask the question, and that is, after you've printed your print, you say, now, to get another copy, do I have to go through all of that again? And I asked Al that question, and he said, unfortunately, yes. Still, it was. I was beginning to get, I began to get clues as to what you could do with an etching plate. And so that year, I applied for a Fulbright. I had heard very good things about England. I'd seen a lot of the prints that were coming out of England at that time. And I had been to France a number of times as a painter, and I thought that England looked attractive. I thought I'd really get deeper into the scene there because of the language. I had struggled with French, and I had made progress, but it was always a little difficult. So I got my Fulbright, and it was to the Slade School. And it was the 56-57, and I really lucked out because the instructor in etching there, which is like the head of the etching department, the instructor is like a full professor, was Anthony Gross, a fine artist and a gentleman and a very warm person who... He loved his foreign students because they came to work. And etching at Slade was a peripheral subject. It essentially was a painting and sculpture school, as Berkeley had been, so that was familiar to me. But they did have a course in lithography and in etching, and Gross taught the etching. It was very frustrating for him because the students with their major in painting or sculpture would kind of dance into his studio for 15 minutes and work on their wretched little 2-inch squares of copper, and then they'd find a reason to go back to the painting studio and work on their painting. So it was very frustrating to a guy who was a first-rate, highly experienced man, but he didn't know how to deal with it. So he would have, there would be a few scholarship students from other countries, or there'd be a few adults who were coming in for special work. And so we were his group. We were there all the time. And I really wanted to learn etching, and I liked my work. I liked London, and I liked Tony Gross. He was a humorous man and a very shrewd man, you know, just the kind of person that I needed to work with. He was an older man, so there was a certain kind of maturity there. He was highly experienced. He was a close friend of Hayter, and he had spent time at Hayter's studio in Paris. He had taught in Madrid. He'd been associated with the Academy in Madrid and had spent a lot of time in Spain. His wife was a French woman, and they had a property in southern France that they would go to quite often. He was up on all of the most recent developments in etching, so that instead of the kind of black and white, small, kind of crabbed etchings that one saw in the States, the Joseph Pennell sort of thing, he showed us the work of the French painters who spent a lot of time in the print studios. I mean, we saw Picasso's prints, we saw Jacques Villon, and we saw wonderful things. Because, of course, the Slade didn't have an enormous slide library, but they were next door to the British Museum, and the British Museum's print room was chock-a-block with the actual prints. I remember going over there and getting out the Goyas at one time, and you know, just this wealth of Goyas, not just one set of the Disasters of War, but three sets, each printed at a different time, one under Goya's supervision and one a much finer printing after he was dead, and so forth. So it was a wonderful print education, and very fine supervision. And again, Tony remained, he became a friend and a mentor, and remained so really until his death. I did get back to London several times. I was back on my Guggenheim, so I had a full year there in the 60s. And at that time, I really got to know him very well and went over and spent some time in France with him at his chateau, which was the remnants of a Romanesque chateau that had really been destroyed. What he really owned was the cellar of a Romanesque chateau in the middle of a vineyard, but it was still pretty nice. Well, anyway, that brings me back to this print, which I think was the best print that I did there. It really wasn't the first print that I did. I went through a long series of prints, but my work at this time had become abstract from the sort of figuration of the earlier work. You can, if you really look in a certain way, you can see that it is based on the head, and it's called Mac 5. And my idea was, I've always have been interested in flying, and the idea of flying and speed and breaking the sound barrier, and sort of the disintegration, disintegration of the body under the force of speed, so that there is a nose and there are eyes and so forth. So it is roughly a discordant figuration. And this proved to be a very good exhibition print. I think I did exhibit this in the for a few years, and it got lots of exposure. I was still doing silk screens. I had in London, I had a separate studio. Besides working at Slade, I had my own studio where I did silk screens and painting. And so this is from roughly the same period. I think this is actually a little later. And it's the same idea, really, only here is the head, and now you see a little bit of the cockpit and the exhaust fire, but working with the same thing of the effect of speed on a human shape. And you can see too, I was pushing the medium. I was trying to open it up. I was, instead of brushing on my touche, I would dribble my touche on. I would drop splatters. I would use a sponge underneath the screen and wipe off the glue and make, you can tell how leaky the screen is by looking at the borders. You can see there's a fine screen-like residue on the margins, because my screen was so leaky that the ink was getting through at all points. And this was shown at the Brooklyn Museum that year. I don't see the date on it. I think it was about 57. That I guess I mention that because Maurizio Lisansky was juror that year, and so that I had the feeling that that was kind of a coup. That Lisansky, we admired him really. He had put Iowa on the map with their print department. we're getting to the end of my silkscreen career. And I think the tendencies you can see are pushing. After reaching the beginnings of abstraction, I then began to recoil away from it. And I think my natural tendencies, which are narrative and much more specific and idea-oriented. Okay. My painting was similar. There really is, I'm concentrating on the prints because I think that's our issue. But the painting and the prints have always been hand in hand. I still tend to evolve ideas in painting or painting and drawing. And then when the idea begins to formulate to then transfer to, in these days, the screens, and now onto the plates. So this is interior morning, the idea of light on figures, a studio with mobiles and furniture and backlit and just playing with vision with very loose open screens and carrying the work into lots of screens. There's probably 12 screens on this. And I would work with, I might have two or three screens that I would get an image, print it up, gamble on it, wash out the screen, put more work on that screen, and so forth. So that you could end up with a print or you could end up with nothing. And there were certainly times when I ended up with nothing. Now my last screen print, and it is actually my last copy. I did it in a small edition. I was becoming less and less interested in editions, although I always did editions, and I still do. I think that's part of the hustling, that really you wanted to get back. You wanted to get income from your work. I felt that was a professional attitude, and so I cultivated it. Now, is this upside down?
No.
Right side up. And it's a little more open than the others. I call it tide pool, and it's just working with the movement of the tide and the shallow rock pools that are full of movement and life. And so it's very open expressionistic piece. A friend who was an importer of Oriental goods, Bob Fry in Chicago, got the last shipment of Chinese tea chest paper, gilded paper that they used to line the tea chests. So he gave me 10 sheets, and I thought it would be wonderful stuffed. It's actually real leaf, in this case it's silver leaf, onto tissue in a big, fragile looking sheet, but actually this is done in 57 or 8, and I think it's in mint condition. I reframed it for the circulating show, and the paper is as fresh as when I did it. And with all of the screening on it, and with that, the light, the force of the light from the silver leaf through the inks, I think makes a very effective piece. But at the same time, I really had lost interest in the medium because of my new interest in etching. And I was also beginning to realize that the etching, of course, is very time-consuming, it's very slow, and I, as the involvement with the university and with teaching was growing too, so that something had to give, and it was the painting, as it turned out, that gave way. And so I really began to paint, much less. I've got two prints here that show attempts to combine silkscreen with etching, just as Meeker did, as he began to go over into calligraph. We really were very independent of one another. I would, you know, I'd see his work occasionally, but I don't think there was an influence, and vice versa. Now, in this case, I had gotten more interested in dry point, and this really is practically a pure dry point. It's a dry point on two plates, on a black plate and on a green plate, so that the drawing then is done on both plates and the plates are printed in sequence, so the image then contains the reading of both plates. And the blue is silkscreen. And in my case, I thought that I could print directly on one of the plates and then simply print it, that the ink would remain wet long enough to be printed onto the paper along with the material etched or drawn into the plate. And it did. I really had no trouble with getting these to print. I think maybe the difference is that I was more into transparent inks than Dean was. And so my inks, which had a lot of transparent base in them, the blue is very transparent, and it would tend to soak into the paper, and it wouldn't work on the intaglio work. And but it was a lot of trouble to get one color, to get this extra color. It had the one color into each plate, that's two colors, and then on top of one of the plates, the third color. So to get a three color print, it was an enormous effort, because you know, the old point of, do I have to do all of that again to get another copy? And yes, you had to clean all three plates. You had to clean your screen, or else the ink would dry in the screen. So there was this enormous time after you got your print, where you had to clean up and get ready to print another one. And since I was doing editions, I began to look for other ways. I liked what was happening, but I began to look for easier ways to do it. But I kept doing it for a while, and I think I began to get the things got more closely integrated. This one is a kind of modern day Medusa. And you can see the plates are getting, in this case, the dry point is on the black plate only. And the underplate, I was using my children's toys and pressing them into soft ground. This was, my son had little cars, little plastic cars, and he was delighted to bring his toys to me, and I'd put them into the press and grind them through and ruin them before his very eyes, and he loved it. So, but the orange, the luminous or yellow orange in here, that is silkscreen, and again, requiring the big cleanup. Now my pictures really are more and more, as we look at these, they reflect things that happen to me and things that I experience that I might put together. And this actually was the sculpture studio at in the education building, which was next to the etching room. And by this time I was teaching etching. But when I got back from my Fulbright year, Sessler proposed that he would separate the printmaking classes. He wanted to specialize more in lithography and relief printing, and the part that interested him the least, and that he did the least himself, was the etching. And I was full of fire and brimstone, and enthusiastically agreed. And so we shared the etching studio there, that I taught on Monday and Wednesday, and he taught on Tuesday and Thursday. So we would, it worked out very well. We shared the same office, the same desk, but on different days. Next door was a very busy, active sculpture studio of Leo Steppen. And he also had a mate in there, Italo Scanga. And so this is actually pretty much from life. This is Italo Scanga in the sculpture studio. He was a kind of wild man, a young Italian guy, very exuberant, outgoing, and a terrific worker. And so, and in those days, sculpture meant welding. They were welding night and day. And the piece in the center is kind of interesting too. It really, that all relates. Because I shared a lot of sculpture students. Etching and sculpture have a lot in common in the use of tools and so forth. And so I had a young guy who was a sculptor, and he was pretty good in printmaking too. And he would get into trouble with his plates, so that he would have to go through this long, slow process of erasing, which is a big negative to anybody. And he had this choice of erasing, and I looked at it, and then I went away. And when I came back, I found that he had simply cut out the part that wasn't working. He had gone over to sculpture and he'd taken a cutting torch and he had removed that whole section, you know. And I looked at it and I thought, this is brilliant. This is brilliant. And it became incorporated into the studio's technique. Not necessarily with a cutting torch, but you could do it with shears or with anything. And so here you have a plate where there's a lot of cutting. I mean, this is somebody's old worn-out plate that I cut into a kind of rough sculptor figure. Cut out the window so that the underplate then comes through in a pure form, you know, and not mixed with the overplate. It is also a la poupée, that is, the underplate is inked in several colors rather than one color. And I think this is a good plate to show as, you know, what was happening to technique, that I was really sort of, the process was being altered and worked on and being changed. And of course, teaching helps in this. You know, you really are a part of a group when you take this kind of technical subject and you work together. So, let's see, a date. This is 66. So it is actually this was done in London during my Guggenheim year, which I was 65, 66. And so it is a reflection of sort of a different kind of social scene. My wife and I had been taken to a very luxurious restaurant, an opulent restaurant that seemed to me smacked of decadence. And I'd been told by someone that this restaurant that where we went to, it was where the upper class men that worked in the city, they'd bring their girlfriends to before going home to their home in the country. And so looking around, you know, I saw sin. Probably was all very innocent, but that's what I saw. We had a very well-heeled relative who came to London pretty regularly. He had taken us out to this, and so we had this. And this print did very well indeed. It was every now and then you do a print that would win prizes and sell quite well and sort of catch on. And Ziggy was a notable print in that regard. You see, again, I was pretty regularly cutting the plates. I liked the idea of cutting the key plate and letting the bottom plate come through. And in this case, cutting out a little figure of Mammon and having him coming up through the floor. This is a little separate piece that's cut out and laid on top and then printed. But still, the main drawing element is dry point, that I really was still enamored with drawing directly with a diamond point onto the copper. So subject matter. The date, I guess, this is signed on the rear because it's a bleed print, and so I'm not really sure of the date, but it is during the Vietnam War, which was very much upfront in this period in Madison. The war had a tremendous effect on the university, on the students, and on the faculty. We were all drawn into it in one degree or another. And at one point, of course, we had the National Guard. We had National Guard snipers on the roof of the Humanities Building, and we had tear gas within our control ventilation system. And so for days, we had watery eyes. I remember our visiting artist, Jack Beale, who attended a meeting up on the hill that turned into a riot. And he came, this sort of big, heavy man, came staggering into the etching room, collapsing, weeping copiously. He had been gassed out. Famous artist, gassed out on campus. So it was on my mind, you know, this struggle. And it seems as if everyone was in conflict, you know. So this is a print I like. It's a strange print. I never have sold many of these. But to me, it is a Vietnam War print where I have them in a dance, you know, all the opposites, all of the forces that hated one another and were at odds. A hawk and a dove, for example, locked in a dance, which I have always seen dancing as something of a struggle. And prim and proper people with very improper people, age opposites and age opposites in gender, opposites in race, opposites in economics, opposites in race, opposites in battle, and so forth. But I had been reading Arthur Schnitzler too, and I was reading La Ronde, and so I was thinking that he was saying much the same thing. And so, and with the idea of watchers, I do like a chorus, watching. And so I would get these old newspaper plates, zinc or copper plates, from the daily Wisconsin paper and ink them up and work them in so that you have, these are Rotarians or businessmen, and they're watching in a kind of neutral way. Etching is so slow that you have a lot of time to think while you work on your plates. And so you're often, I find myself thinking ahead to the next plate. And I think that leads very naturally into a portfolio of prints, or prints that are related to one another, the kind of sequence of prints. It's natural for me then to do prints in groups. And so this is a part of a group that I called Histories, or Colescott's USA, Histories, taking historic events, American history events, and portraying them as basically as comedies. And so the print from this set that really got the most attention and was in a lot of important shows this recently was at the Smithsonian in Washington. They own a copy of this, and so it's really gotten around a lot. And this is the only copy that I have. This is my exhibition copy. So this is 1973. Vietnam has been solved, so one can go back to history, and this is Secretary Seward buying Alaska in the middle of a good Wisconsin snowstorm. Another one from the same set. George Washington meets Betsy Ross, but too late. She was Betsy Ross, a very comely woman, if you've ever seen her picture, which is what started me on this. There's a painting of Washington meeting with Betsy Ross. She's sewing up the flag and so forth, and they're sort of glancing at one another. So I saw it as more contemporary activity. And then the Puritans, who are always with us, and a nice Puritan picnic, the first Thanksgiving. There is a popular painter, he was popular in the 20s, and I have seen his pictures of the first Thanksgiving, for example. Very lavish, sort of patriotic moments in history. And that was behind a number of the prints that I did, sort of do a takeoff on his approach. And so this is the first Thanksgiving, a little more the way it might have really been, with the meeting of all of the diverse groups and in the background, the witches being pilloried and actually spelling out witch. For a while, I had been interested in Dillinger and in the bank robbing period. I guess coming to the Midwest from California, became aware of the myth and the stories in the states where he operated. I mean, it's all faded away a little now, but visiting the Biograph Theater, where he was finally shot by the FBI. And so I worked that in as one of the histories of my series. And this is J. Edgar Hoover at the Biograph Theater. And at that time, the time I did this, this was in 73, no one else really had that take on J. Edgar Hoover. So I think this, I was a little ahead of my time in the portrayal of Hoover. I think he is more generally looked at the way I was looking at him in 73. I did a group of five paintings on Dillinger. He had operated in five Midwestern states, and so I did each state. I did an Iowa incident, an Illinois incident, an Indiana incident, and a Wisconsin incident. We're actually, next week, we're going up to Little Bohemia. We're going to go up to Minocqua, and we're going to have dinner at Little Bohemia, which is still going as a restaurant. This dry point with lots of additions, dry point on two plates, actually it's a dry point on one plate, and it's inked twice. So the plate, the same plate goes through the press twice, once with a red ink and once with a black ink, so you get this kind of tonal variation in it. With stencilings, which I was using instead of the difficulty of working with silk screens to get additional color, I found it was just so simple to cut a simple paper stencil and to roll with a small roller to roll ink through, as you would in inking up a woodcut or a linoleum cut. And using for photo additions, newspaper zinc letterpress cuts, which I would gather up from friendly printers, and I'd keep a big cardboard box of these things, and as I needed them, I'd select, just as you would make a collage, and cut them and fit them in to try to give a little here, the spirit of the time and the bombast and the indoor and outdoor effect of this rowdy battle, which really was a very strange affair, in which no one got hurt except two bystanders who were killed by the FBI. Very, very curious.
A little Waco.
Yeah.
I'm going to end tape one side.